And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You already know that global warming is real, that changes are happening, and that everyone is beginning to know we have to do something about it. But what? The age of regulation, administration, and fines is just not going to work on a global basis. But innovation just may. And the strategy to ignite real innovation around the world is referred to as cap and trade. What is it? And what's it mean to you? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This past week, in the nation's capital, at a Senate hearing on climate change, chaired by California Senator Boxer, the chairman and CEO of Pacific Gas and Electric, Peter A. Darby, opened his testimony with this.
On behalf of PG&E Corporation and the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, or U.S. CAP, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. PG&E is California's largest energy provider. Our company is also one of the nation's cleanest utilities, and we're an acknowledged leader in energy efficiency. U.S. CAP is a unique alliance of leading companies from diverse sectors of the economy and major environmental organizations. Our organization is here because we share a view that climate change is the most pressing environmental issue of our time, and also because we agree that as the world's largest source of global warming emissions, our country has an obligation to lead. No other country matches the U.S. in terms of our capital resources and its capacity for innovation. Our economy is the world's locomotive, and U.S. CAP believes it is critical to get that engine pulling in the right direction on climate change. Toward that end, we've outlined an aggressive but entirely achievable set of public policy principles and a legislative framework. This morning, I'll talk about three areas in particular: improving energy efficiency, developing a smart grid for electricity, and making smart decisions about the diversity of the fuels we use to generate electricity. Keep in mind, the backdrop is our recommendation favoring a program that creates a long-term price signal for carbon by creating a mandatory cap on greenhouse gas emissions, combined with a trading program that uses the market to establish that long-term price signal and lets companies figure out how best to meet the goals. I personally believe we are going to meet the challenges we're talking about today. But as I've said, I'm also a realist, and I recognize that doing so will be tough. We're going to need your continued support and leadership. On behalf of PG&E and U.S. CAP, thank you for the opportunity to be part of a serious discussion on this very serious issue. We look forward to working with you going forward.
Along with Mr. Darby were the CEOs from both British Petroleum and DuPont, and they were of one mind about global warming, climate change, and the pressing need to act. When players at this level commit, we can know that change is coming, and the change that you'll be hearing a lot about will be carbon cap and trade. In a nutshell, it says that a company in one part of the world, Los Angeles for example, will be able to purchase carbon credits from a company which produces cleaner energy in Minnesota or Arizona, and thus offset their carbon footprint, which may exceed the limits or caps imposed by regional, state, and some would hope, national and eventually international regulations. It's a very complex and confusing concept for many to grasp, and that's why a conference is happening in San Francisco on March 5th and 6th called the 2007 Global CO2 Cap and Trade Forum, to bring together major decision makers and stakeholders and the public at large to provide a better understanding of the emerging CO2 cap and trade markets, which some say will become one of the hottest markets in years to come, shuffling and investing hundreds of billions of dollars ultimately to drive the greenhouse gases from the environment and hopefully turn the specter of global warming around. Today, we hear from two of the presenters of the Global Cap and Trade Forum. We go in-depth in segments 1 and 2 with the managing director of Cantor Fitzgerald, who discusses the challenges all the way from the emerging local to the future global strategies. I know you'll find this discussion extremely useful in understanding this complex issue. In segment 3, we head up to Portland, Oregon, where we talk with the executive director of the Carbon Trust, which has been active in the cap-and-trade arena for 10 years. Oregon is way ahead of others in implementing their legal and administrative system, and cap-and-trade is alive and well and making history that others are watching carefully. So without further fanfare, let's find out what carbon cap-and-trade is going to mean in your life and the lives of your children and your children's children and your children's children's children and your children's children's children. I'm going to be up in San Francisco in March. I'm looking forward to that. San Francisco is always a wonderful city to visit. And I'm going up there because there is going to be a conference that's dealing with this issue of CO2 cap and trade. The global CO2 cap and trade movement really is what it is. And there's the 2007 CCAT forum that's happening in Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, March 5th and 6th, and it's open to everybody. And to help us understand the CO2 cap and trade, and as well to talk about what this means on a personal, business, and national, international, and global level, is the managing director of Cantor Fitzgerald, Josh Margolis. Josh, I want to welcome you to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a huge topic, carbon cap and trade. Very difficult for me to understand, for others to understand, and we're going to try to get into that such that the average person can get a better grasp of why this is important and what it really means and what they can do. They can play in this game from any number of different levels. But first of all, I'd like to get a little background about yourself and how it is that you're involved in what we might call the Wall Street world of finance and brokerage and trading and, in essence, sort of commodity trading, a new form of commodities. Is there something beyond that that has brought you to become focused in this particular area? Some people are just in it for the money, okay? Most people that think about investments and Wall Street and commodity trading and things, think about people who are in it for the money. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with making money. And that's something that we have to learn as environmentalists, but there's all sorts of ways to make money. And I'm curious if it's just money or if there's something else that brought you to this point.
What brought me here was my dad. He set me out on a path in the First Earth Day in 1970. And I distinctly remember walking down the street on a country road in New Hampshire, picking up trash and talking with my dad about the social responsibility that we have with our good fortune to be in the position we are, the society that we're in, with the opportunities we have comes a responsibility to give back. He was the sort of fellow who didn't ask why me. He said, why not me? That was the first step. I then ended up learning how to scuba dive at an early age. Worked briefly for EPA as an intern. Thought that's where I was going to go in order to affect social change in the environment. Ended up working for a private industry. First in the consulting firm my job was to assess environmental compliance at industrial facilities, and also look for ways that they could better comply and turn their waste streams into profit streams. Then I got into the emissions trading world, back in the mid-80s, working for a company that, was the first emissions trading specialty firm, and then joined eventually Cantor Fitzgerald in October of 1995.
It's obvious that this is something that's very close to your heart, and that you take this all very seriously, that you care about the earth. Now you're working in this concept of carbon credits and trading. You've mentioned that you got started in 1988. Was this with the sulfur trading?
No, actually, in the mid-80s, the focus was on new source review offsets. The law was pretty straightforward. It served as a break on the economy. The law said that in areas of the country where the air was not good, failed to attain the standards established by Congress, these are health-based standards, that you couldn't expand a refinery, a manufacturing operation. So if you were in Los Angeles or Houston or New Jersey or San Francisco or the San Joaquin Valley, and the air was bad, and you went to get a permit to put on a new line, new tanks, etc., the regulators would say, sorry, you can't do that because you're going to make the air quality worse. Until somebody said, you know what, I think we have a way that we can accommodate both environmental improvements as well as growing the economy. Let's let this guy have a permit to expand his refinery so long as he accomplishes a reduction somewhere else in the airshed. This was the idea of new source review offsets. So if you pay somebody else to accomplish a reduction that's beyond that which is required by law, that's quantifiable, that's enforceable, that's surplus, then you can take a portion of those emission reductions and use them at your new refinery. And this idea of new source review offsets, that's been around since the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
The S-RAIN program came about in 1990 as a result of the first President Bush. He was enamored with the idea of using the market to accomplish environmental change and to allowing for economic growth. And it's actually one of the most successful programs that that we've seen so far.
It has been a struggle between forces that would say that somehow the government should really step in and take measures to regulate versus a free market economy where somehow we're able to, rather than regulate and have people come in and enforce and fine, there may be a different power, which has to do with the power of the purse, and that if things become too costly, then someone will find an alternative.
I think you put your finger on a good part of it. This idea of emissions trading, the idea of a cap-and-trade program, allows the government to do what it does best and the industry to do what it does best. The government is very good at enforcing establishing the standards, defining what's safe and what's not safe,
mm-hmm.
at enforcing against those who don't comply, at assessing compliance and at enforcing against those who don't comply, at penalizing those who don't comply. They're not so good at figuring out the best way to produce a product, to manufacture a widget, and in fact, they're not the best at figuring out how to reduce emissions. They aren't there on site. They don't know the processes like the manufacturing operators do. The manufacturers, on the other hand, they're motivated by, absent any other corporate goals, by producing a product that's better than anybody else's. And reducing the impact of that product on the bottom line. If they see that there's a cost to producing a product with significant emissions, they're going to look at a way, they're going to try to figure out how to reduce those emissions costs. They're going to look at a way, try to figure out how they can reduce the cost to the point where they turn the waste streams into profit streams. This idea of a cap-and-trade program, it's where you see the collision of some two very powerful ideas. Those who have a problem, and those are the manufacturers who are producing a product who have been given the mandate to reduce emissions, and those who have an idea. The idea is that they can compete with each other to reduce emissions in the most cost-effective way. And when you have this sort of competition, you have a number of different air quality entrepreneurs all competing with each other to come up with the best way to reduce emissions. And it's from this competition that you come up with these innovative, novel solutions that allow you to comply at levels that are far below that which the government could have mandated.
I think maybe where some people begin to wonder, how does this actually factor? You were, for example, talking about in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. in an area where there's high pollution. So that really becomes almost like a city or a regional cap-and-trade system.
Sure. Mm-hmm. The government takes a look at the meteorology of the area, sees that that you have a bowl of mountains within which the air quality acts and with some the air and the meteorology acts in some consistent ways, and you can pretty well predict what the air is going to do and how much pollution is going to be in the air at any given set of circumstances.
So the objective there is to really lower the amount of carbon dioxide, if we focus on carbon dioxide, in that specific area. So that becomes, in essence, a regional marketplace, an active regional marketplace where there can be limits placed and therefore the trading can exist within that zone.
Well, it's probably better to focus on not so much on CO2 in Los Angeles, because CO2 is really a global pollutant, and the scientists will tell us that a ton of reductions in Los Angeles are equal to a ton of reductions in bulk air.
Well, that's what I want to move out to, is how do we then get the larger perspective, and you're making exactly the right leap, okay? So for example, in L.A., if it was possible to regulate the amount of CO2, it would work, and it has worked in many cases. What's the next sort of chain of the process here in is setting these criteria for industry, giving out the credits, and then ultimately what you're involved in, and that is brokering these. But let's go up to the next level.
We go from the scientists. The scientists, they're the ones that we turn to and say, what's the carrying capacity of the atmosphere? How much can we absorb before we suffer the consequences? The scientists give us their best answers. The politicians then take over and they say, how do we come up with the best way to address this problem? And it's up to the politicians, frankly, to decide if there's a problem. If the scientists say that there's a problem and the politicians don't agree, then we're left with the politicians deciding that it's okay to have this level of pollution in the air.
Good point.
And if we don't, and if we have politicians that decide that and the people don't like it, then it's up to the people to affect a regime change, to look for new politicians. And it's interesting how now, for example, we have San Francisco values that are now in Washington, embodied by Barbara Boxer and Nancy Pelosi. And Governor Schwarzenegger has stepped up to the plate.
Absolutely
said,
right.
The debate is over. We're not going to talk about whether or not there's a problem. We know there's a problem. It's time to solve the problem.
Yep.
So how to solve the problem? We have a choice. We can tell people exactly what to do and how to do it and tell how to manufacture the products and what controls to use. Or we can give them a declining checkbook, an emissions cap.
Mm-hmm.
You're allowed to emit 1,000 tons this year, 900 tons next year, 800 tons the following year, all the way down to the point where you, as an individual manufacturing operation, like your brethren, folks in the geographic area, have had to accomplish reductions. And with this declining checkbook, with the need to operate within this cap, you have made choices along the way. Do I reduce my emissions by shutting down? By curtailing operations? Well, hopefully not. Do I find new ways to produce my product in ways that are less intensive in terms of carbon and NOx and SOx and particulate matter? And should I do that myself, or should I pay somebody else to reduce their emissions? Well, I should probably pay somebody else to reduce their emissions if it costs them less than it costs me to do it on site. And that way, as an on the aggregate level, the economy benefits. Everybody benefits. We get the biggest bang for the buck, the biggest reduction for the dollar.
Help me and listeners understand, how are those credits determined? That's what I'm trying to get a handle on. There's the national, there's state, there's regional. Give me a sense of where that's moving, how that's developing. Because this is a new economic science.
Well, most scientists, in fact, most politicians who believe that there's a global warming problem, believe that you look at the carrying capacity of the Earth with respect to CO2. It makes sense to figure out how much CO2 can be absorbed in the atmosphere, how much greenhouse gases can be absorbed in the atmosphere before we have too much, before we reach a tipping point, before we can't reverse the trend. The choice is to either look at the budget as the Earth's budget, or to look at it as the U.S. budget, or the India's budget, or China's budget. From starting from scratch, it makes sense to do it on the global level. But we have certain realities. The realities are that we have different countries which are autonomous. Folks have decided to participate in the Kyoto Treaty. Others have decided not to. Those who have decided to participate have decided that it makes sense to act in unison and to affect change amongst all of the Kyoto countries and invite others to participate. Those who have stood on the outside, such as Australia and the U.S., have decided that it's not appropriate to participate. So we have politicians who have decided where there's a problem and how best to solve it. Those politicians are also the ones who have decided how to allocate emission reductions, how to allocate the cap, how to allocate emission reduction responsibilities.
Okay, let's talk about the United States, because I understand the conflict here between where the U.S. is and compared with most of the rest of the world, and that's what I want to do, is really talk about the United States. So people understand how it is what they do and how it is that the decisions that are made in their region, in their city, in their state, and in their nation, really do have a consequence, because it's a big world. It's a huge world. Let's try to develop this model. For example, we could say that there is a national level of carbon emissions that are accepted. That would be a national cap. But that may not happen for a while. So perhaps a state may say, well, in this state, this is the cap that we wish, because we want in on this. We think it's a good thing. Or if a state doesn't, then perhaps a city might decide that they also want to regulate. Where is that? Where do we sit in that process of determining those caps? Because I think it's quite varied.
There are, you're right, Sidney, there are, last count, I think 12 different bills sitting in Congress aimed at global warming, at reducing, at developing a national program. And most all politicians in the state levels, in the regional levels, the local levels, believe that if you're going to solve this problem, you should develop a program on the national level. The problem is that if you wait for the national government to do something, if you wait for President Bush to change his mind, if you wait for him to decide that we should accomplish emission reductions by using a cap and trade program, you're going to find yourselves waiting for the perfect. And in this case, the perfect solution is the national solution, and the perfect is the enemy of the good. And the good enough is what we're seeing emerge from the bottom up. Where we don't have a top-down program coming from Washington, we have a bottom-up program emerging from the states.
That's precisely the point I'm trying to make, that we're starting at the ground level here and trying to make some, we're developing this market because it is not coming from the top.
It's the market that's the solution from the top is one that many folks in California have decided, in the regional greenhouse gas initiative in the Northeast states, in other states, have decided is not good enough, is not fast enough, is not aggressive enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you see folks in California, in Sacramento, in Albany, in the Northeast, who said we're going to solve this problem ourselves. It's not ideal for us to do it all by ourselves, but if we're successful, we're going to make a difference both in California and the Northeast, and perhaps we establish a wave that washes throughout the country. In that way, you're not waiting for something that may never come from Washington.
You got to start somewhere.
You have to start somewhere. And if you talk to the folks in Sacramento and Governor Schwarzenegger, who's undertaken a pretty aggressive goal, which is to reduce emissions by upwards of 30% by the year 2020, that is a tremendously aggressive goal. It's a goal that will change the economy in California, that will affect every single individual in the state of California in ways that can't be, at this point, ascertained. But it's also a goal that is not the end point. It's not where the governor wants to go. If we only cause change in California, the program will not be a success. The program will only be a success if you look at other states who have signed on. Other localities, other regional government entities have signed on that have decided that they want to participate as well, and that they have signed on to the same goals, and California then will have acted as a catalyst.
That's exactly correct. But now I also want to say, now let's talk about implementing in California, because I really want to get a handle on how this will emerge. It's time to bring this on home, and we do, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Well,
melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.